Well, this has been a class on how to keep fear from scaring you to death. Been kind of a fascinating journey for me. I think that life kind of prepares us, or at least provides a real good environment for us to learn to not be very brave. Anybody a first grade teacher in here? If you have a big old class of first graders, 30 of them, and you say, who wants to draw a picture and show it to the class? Nearly everybody will. Am I right about that? That's because they think they're a great artist. But you let them grow about 7 years and ask the same question to an eighth grade class. Who wants to draw a picture and show it to the class? Only some really weird people will do that, right? Everybody else doesn't want to do it. What happened? Yeah. Scared somebody won't like their picture. Life prepares us to be scared. And a lot of it has to do with words that are thrown around. I've done an awfully lot of self-analysis of myself as to why I'm so scared of people, or have been in my life, and scared of talking, scared of speaking. And the best I can figure, it has to do with my upbringing. And it has something to do with four older siblings that jumped on me every time I said something. And I couldn't say anything right. I couldn't walk right. I couldn't do facial expressions right. Couldn't do anything right. And in fact, I specifically remember my older brother one time when I was four. He wanted me to read something, and I couldn't. And he said, what's the matter? Can't you read? Well, I'm four. I hadn't been to first grade yet. And I called my dad a liar one time. And, man, that didn't go over. But I really did not have... I really did not have bad intentions. I just didn't know how to tell him I disagreed with him. I remember I was standing in the bathroom, and he was in his bedroom, which was right around the corner, and he said something that wasn't true, because he just didn't know that it wasn't true, and I wanted to correct him, but I didn't know how to say, "Oh man, I remember it this way," or something like that. I didn't know how to do that. I said, "Well, you're a liar." Well, I learned right there that what you really ought to do is think really long and hard before you say something, and then don't say it. That's caused issues in my marriage. Because my wife will ask me something, and 15 minutes later I'm thinking about it and haven't said anything. And she thinks I don't care. And so we've had to work through some of that stuff. But isn't that funny how the little insignificant things of life have such a profound effect on our mental well-being and how we can, you know, it's kind of amazing to me. So I've had to learn to get through a bunch of that stuff. And I suspect that perhaps you guys have had some of the same types of things happen to you. Because fear is pretty pervasive among humans, and it might not be fear of speaking, but it might be fear of something else. Listen to this one time. David was putting together his 30 mighty men, and he was putting together his army. And listen to about Benaiah, B-E-N-A-I-A-H. I'm not sure it's called Benaiah, but I'm going to call him that right now. 1 Chronicles 11:22 said that Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was a valiant fighter from Kabzeel, who performed great exploits. He struck down two of Moab's best men. He also went down into a pit on a snowy day and killed a lion. And he struck down an Egyptian who was 7.5 feet tall. And although the Egyptian had a spear like a weaver's rod in his hand, Benaiah went against him with a club. He snatched the spear from the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear. And such were the exploits of Benaiah, son of Jehoiada. He too was as famous as the three mighty men, and David put him in charge of his bodyguard. I want to be like that guy. And I'm actually becoming like that guy. Does that make you uncomfortable? I'm actually way more like Benaiah now than I was 20 years ago. Now, is that bragging? What is that? Have I got some kind of an ego thing going on here that I would actually admit that I'm getting better? What about you? Do you have a little bit of trouble admitting that you're getting better when you are getting better? Did you know that if you can't admit you're getting better, it's real hard to get better? And I think that we're created to be courageous. And that's what I want to talk about some today. We've talked about how to be courageous a lot. You know, all the foundation that we've laid over the last few weeks, part of our confidence, it comes from faith. And faith is simply trying to trust something you can't see. And it's really not specifically a religious term. Faith is more like a behavioral term. And I know some of y'all are getting sick of listening to me say this particular illustration, but it's really powerful. I went yesterday or day before to one of our pastors to see a horse that was supposed to have a baby. She didn't have it yet. Wasted a trip. But If I take off on four-wheeler and my wife says, "Where are you going?" I say, "I'm going to check on the horses in the north pasture." Well, there's a north pasture, and then there's a bunch of woods, and there's another pasture, and there are no fences. And she said, "Well, how do you know they're there?" Well, how do I know they're there? Anybody? Yes, sir.
From experience, every time you look for them, that's where you found
them. I have some evidence from past history that they might be there. That's correct. And the other part of the truth is that I don't know they're there. I just think they are. And so I say, "Well, I don't know they're there." Then why are you going? "Well, I'm going to go and see if I find out if they're there or not." So I take off on my four-wheeler, and the four-wheeler's wheels turn just as if I knew exactly where the horses were. But what if I had a little video camera set up in the north pasture and hooked into my computer at home, and I look on it, and then I say, "Hey, I'm going to the north pasture." "What are you going there for?" "I'm going there to get the horses." "How do you know they're there?" "How do I know?" "I saw them. I know they're there." So I take off and go. Okay, one of them is I'm going to the north pasture not really knowing that it's there, and I drive on a four-wheeler. The other scenario is I see the horses on the video, and I know they're there. So I get on the four-wheeler, and I go. And I kind of look like this if I'm going, and I really don't know the horses are there. It looks kind of like this. Okay, I don't really know they're there, but I'm going that way. Here's how it looks if I do know the horses are there. It's the exact same walk. You can't tell the difference, except that one of them, I'm just not too sure what the outcome is. That's what they call walking by faith. That's all that is. That's what we're called to do. Walk by faith. If we knew, it wouldn't be faith. But we don't know, so we kind of suspect. And the longer we live, I tell you, I think I've figured out that the guys who walk with God a long, long time are better at that because of the evidence that they've seen in the past life. We're just pretty sure that God's going to take care of us. What a great truth that is. And so part of my boldness then comes from this faith walk. I don't know for sure. Somebody say, "Well, you don't know the horses are there, so what's your evidence that they're there?" What is the evidence that they're there? Part of it is history. What's the other part of it? I'm going to get them. That's evidence. Noah, build an ark. Okay, I'm doing it. All right, Noah, why are you building an ark? Because it's going to rain. What's your evidence that it's going to rain? God said it, and I'm building a boat. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. So I submit to you then that the evidence of the not seen things that we're walking toward is the fact that we're walking toward them. That is evidence. Isn't that a neat thought? I might be wrong about that, but I don't think so. I think it makes sense from a certain direction. So this faith walking actually builds our confidence because we're building a relationship, like we talked between a father and a son relationship. And here's something that has bothered me a long time, and I wanted to share it with you. I've done a good deal of church going in my life. And I've noticed myself in my own mind and my behaviors and my lifestyle, and I've noticed that of those around me. And I've noticed that it's possible to go to church a whole lot and pretty well prevent it from impacting our lifestyles very much. And it's possible to go to church every time and have a totally powerless life and be full of fear all the time. And I have to ask myself why that is. What is going on here that the church doesn't necessarily result in what we thought it would result in? Where's the power in my life? Here's a thought that a guy shared with me. We go to a place called, let me see if I can do this, school. All right, then there's a process that we go through, and we'll call that education. Now, what we hope to get from that is knowledge. That's kind of the process. The school, though, is not knowledge. Right? And neither is education knowledge. School, it's possible to go to school. Jerry Clower said he was headed to school one day, and he met Marcel Ledbetter coming back. And Jerry said, "What are you doing?" Marcel said, "There ain't no point in going to school today. Somebody let the air out the basketball." That's really funny. Well, it's possible then to go to school for reasons other than what it's intended for. And it's possible to have a poor education when you do go to school so that you don't end up with knowledge. Well, okay. Let's see here. We go to a place, most people refer to it as going to church. We realize that the church is the people and it's not the building. But most of the time when we're talking about assembling, we're saying we're going to go to church. So we go to a place we call church. And then at church we engage in a process that we call religion. But the religion is not the end, is it? Religion isn't really what we're hunting. In spite of a common terminology saying he got religion, that really isn't what we're really hunting. What are we hunting? What we end up with is a relationship. And that's also known as spirituality. But church is not the relationship. And neither is the religion the relationship. So, but what church does, or what the assembly does, provides a really good avenue to engage in these processes, which results in just a really, really good relationship with God, if it's practiced diligently and in accordance with the truth. But that explains, though, how you can go to church and be pretty sorry in your lifestyle, because it doesn't really necessarily compute to an improved life. Well, anybody want to argue with me or anything? Any questions about this? Our confidence comes from this relationship with God that we're talking about. And regarding church attendance, I fall asleep in church. Y'all ever? I have a tendency to. And so I was talking to my good buddy about it one time, and I was kind of half joking, but not really. I said, "Jerry, what is the point in me going to church, because all I do is fall asleep?" Good question. And he said, "Well, when you were a little boy, you ate a lot of meals. And some of them you really hated. Some of them you loved. Most of them you don't remember. But you grew up." Ain't that a neat thought? So maybe the purpose of the assembly is not so that I can get on top of the world every time that I attend. It might be so that I can grow across time without even knowing it. I just keep on doing it, keep on doing it, keep on doing it. That's a neat thought. So if you're tempted to quit assembling together because you're not getting anything out of it, I submit to you that it's premature to judge whether you're getting anything out of it or not, because you might be without knowing it. Good thoughts. So this kind of faith that we're talking about, this confidence, comes also from knowing that we can live this type of life even if God kills us. John the Baptist, it was who we talked about last time. Do y'all know the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? What stands out of that story with you? I won't read it, but what stands out to you? Nebuchadnezzar was the king, right? Babylon, the great empire of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar built a big tower, what was it, 90 feet high, a statue of himself. And on one day, everybody was supposed to bow down to him. So what did these guys do? They didn't bow down. How old were they? They were young. I don't know exactly how old they were, but they weren't really old guys. They were kind of young. What was their reason for not bowing down to that statue? So what did they actually say about that? Yeah, they did. He said, part of it, he said, "I'm going to do this to you if you don't bow down." And then they responded by saying what? Do y'all remember what they said to the king? "Because our God is able." Y'all remember that sentence? I can't remember it exactly. "Our God is able to preserve us. And if he wants to," and then what's the last part of that sentence? "But even if he doesn't, we're not going to bow down to you." Wow. Now that's a pretty serious statement, because you can take a risk with $20, or you can take a risk with an insult, but what about taking a risk with getting thrown into the fire? That's a pretty big deal. So, and then what happened? They did not even smell like smoke when they came back out of that. And also, there were four in there instead of three. Y'all remember that? What?
Three went in and there were four in the fire.
Yeah. Yeah, made it. Right. And it just killed those guys who threw them in there. What an outstanding story that is about boldness and about a God of the too late scenario who can actually save you when it's impossible to save you again. Well, those boys had boldness about them. I submit to you that we were made to be courageous. There's a song about that, or there ought to be. We were made to be courageous, and we were made to be bold like that. And I think we're in a process of that as we learn these truths about these people. modern day Winston Churchill, June 18, I think it was, 1940. I listened to him say this. He says, what General Weigand has called the Battle of France is now over. And I suppose that the Battle of Britain is about to begin. Hitler had beat up France and conquered them. Only thing left in Winston Churchill's viewpoint was the British Empire to keep Hitler from taking over everything. And he gave a speech on that day, perhaps the lowest ebb of the entire era. And he talked about Hitler and his forces, and he talked about what the English people were going to do. And one of the phrases that he used as perhaps the closing phrase of his speech, it was a 31 or 36 minute speech. He said, "Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duties and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last 1,000 years, men will still say this was their finest hour." Winston Churchill wrote that speech as was typical of his speeches, in blank verse, which most of the scholars agree was borrowed from the Old Testament Psalms, of which he was accustomed to reading. After the defeat at the Battle of Bull Run, Abraham Lincoln said, "I have many times been driven to my knees by the firm conviction that there was nowhere else to go. My own wisdom and that of those about me seemed insufficient for that day." A low tide, a low ebb of the war. When they were trying to write the Constitution of the United States in 1787, they had convened and they were trying to make headway, had a hard time with it. Benjamin Franklin stood up, he was 80 years old. Winston Churchill was 65 when he made that speech. Back earlier in 1940. But Benjamin Franklin was 80 years old, and he said something like this: "I've lived, sirs, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I have of this fact, that God governs in the affairs of men." And then he went on to say that if a sparrow can't fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that we can raise an empire without his aid? "And we've been assured, sirs, in the sacred scripture, that unless God builds a house, they who do so labor in vain." And I firmly believe this. "So I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessings on our deliberations be held in this assembly every day." He called for prayers in creating the Constitution. But before he said that, he said this: "In the beginning of the contest with Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayers in this room for divine protection. Our prayers, sir, were heard, and they were graciously answered. All of us who were engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of a superintending providence in our favor. Have we now forgotten this powerful friend, or do we imagine we no longer need his assistance?" Powerful words. In the low tide of human existence, these men who were later believed to be great men penned or voiced these words that inspired immense numbers of people across time. And come to find out, Winston Churchill wasn't all that great of a man. He was just a man. He had notes and edits all over his speech. And he made changes right up to the very last, struggling for the right words to say. I submit to you that we have the exact same ability to bring up the people around us that those guys had. power of a word. Words are immensely powerful, and we can exercise great boldness in the use of them because we have all of this background behind us to prove that God approves and that he's and that his word is true and that his word is dependable. That gives me a lot of encouragement, to tell you the truth. Y'all know about Alexander the Great? I want to talk about how powerful a word is, because, you know, the chances of any of us having a chance to go into a pit on a snowy day and kill a lion, not very high chance of that. Even if we had a chance, there wouldn't be any point in it, would there? And I'm not sure why he did that, unless he just wanted to. But I saw one time where a lion reached up and scratched a piece of meat that was 9 feet off the ground. 9 feet off the ground, and he was standing on the ground. Lions are right big. But so the chances then of us being called upon to display courage to kill a lion on a snowy day in a pit are very small. But the chances of us having an opportunity to display courage by saying the right thing at the right time to the right person, almost 100%. And what we need to know is that our words that we say are extremely influential and extremely powerful. I just happened to grow up believing that what I said was inconsequential. It didn't make any difference. And so I was hesitant to say anything. However, that's not true. I need to learn something different than that. Alexander the Great was son of Philip of Macedon. The Persian Empire was in power at the time under Darius. Alexander the Great's mom lied to him. Did y'all know that? Lied to him about his father. She said Philip was not his father. You know who she said his father was? Zeus. She told Alexander he was a god. And he believed it. He went to Egypt one time. He was passing through Egypt. And there was an oracle out in one of those oases there. And so he went to visit, I think it was a lady. He went to visit this person. And this person confirmed with him that, yeah, he was indeed a god. Whatever he would do would succeed. So Alexander just went ahead on and believed it. And he dealt a crushing blow to the Persians one time. And Josephus, the historian, Jewish historian, wrote about it. And after he had that fight with Darius, Alexander the Great went and besieged Tyre and Sidon. And one of them fell. And in the course of the siege on the other one, he sent to Jerusalem, to the high priest at Jerusalem, and he said, send us supplies and support, because we need it. And so the priest at Jerusalem, reckon what he said. He said, no, because I have sworn to Darius that I will not lift up any hand against him while he's alive. Well, guess how about that. So Alexander, this is from Josephus, Alexander came into Syria and took Damascus, and when he had obtained Sidon, he besieged Tyre. When he sent an epistle to the Jewish high priest to send him some auxiliaries and to supply his army with provisions, but the high priest answered the messengers that he had given his oath to Darius not to bear arms against him, and he said that he would not transgress this while Darius was in the land of the living. Upon hearing this answer, Alexander was very angry. I reckon. And though he determined not to leave Tyre, which was just ready to be taken, yet as soon as he had taken it, he threatened that he would make an expedition against the Jewish high priest, and through him teach all men to whom they must keep their oaths. That's a pretty serious statement from a guy who's winning the world. And Alexander the Great was at the time. Well, when that happened, Alexander, he went on to take Gaza also, and he made haste to go up to Jerusalem, just like he said he would. And Jaddua, the high priest, when he heard that, was in an agony and under terror, and not knowing how he should meet the Macedonians, since the king was displeased at his foregoing disobedience. Well, he therefore ordained that the people should make supplications and should join with him in offering sacrifices to God, whom he besought to protect that nation, and to deliver them from the perils that were coming upon them. Whereupon God warned him in a dream, which came upon him after he had offered sacrifice, that he should take courage and adorn the city and open the gates, that the rest appear in white garments, that he and the priests should meet the king in the habits proper to their order, without the dread of any ill consequences which the providence of God would prevent. Jaddua, what are you doing? I'm getting dressed up. What are you doing now? I'm opening the gates. What are you doing now? I'm marching out to meet a guy who's going to kill me. Well, how do you know he's not going to kill me? Because God told me, and because I'm marching out this gate. How do you know the horses are there? Because I'm going toward them, and I just think they're there. Walking by faith. Upon which, when he rose from his sleep, he greatly rejoiced. He believed God and declared to all the warning he had received from God, according to which dream he acted entirely, and so waited for the coming of the king. And when he understood that he wasn't far from the city, Jaddua went out in procession with the priest and the multitude of the citizens. The procession was venerable, and the manner of it different from that of other nations. It reached to a place called Sapha, which name means prospect, for you have thence a prospect both of Jerusalem and of the temple. And then when the Phoenicians and the Chaldeans, who were with Alexander, thought that they should have liberty to plunder the city and torment the high priest to death, which the king's displeasure fairly promised them, the very reverse of it happened. For Alexander, when he saw the multitude at a distance in white garments, while the priest stood clothed with fine linen, and the high priest in purple and scarlet clothing, with his mitre on his head, having the golden plate on which the name of God was engraved, Alexander approached by himself and adored that name and first saluted the high priest. And the people who were with him couldn't believe it, and they thought he was disordered in his mind. However, one of his main men, Parmenio, went up to him alone and asked him how it came to pass that when all the others adored him, he should adore the high priest of the Jews. And this is what he says: I didn't adore the high priest. I adored the God who honored him with the high priesthood. Now, why would he do that? He had a dream. Listen to this. For I saw this very person in a dream, in this very habit, when I was at Dios in Macedonia, who, when I was considering with myself how I might obtain the dominion of Asia, exhorted me to make no delay, but boldly to pass over the sea, for that he would conduct my army and would give me the dominion over the Persians. And I haven't seen anybody else in that dress that this Jewish high priest had. And now, seeing this person in it, and remembering that vision and the exhortation which I had in my dream, I believe that I bring this army under the divine conduct, and shall therewith conquer Darius and destroy the power of the Persians, and that all things will succeed according to what's in my mind. He went up into the temple and sacrificed to God, Alexander did. And then they showed him the book of Daniel, in which it says the Greeks will whip the Persians. What a story that is. The power of a word, guys, and I'm nearly done, and thank you for listening today, and thank you for your participation. We're called to be bold, and we're called to be really courageous. And one of the best avenues is in our words. We can build people up without us even knowing we're doing it. Don't you know that people have really influenced you and they never knew it? But it might be a word that they said that built them up, or even a word of or a confronting them on something. We have that power. So we were made to be courageous, guys. And these are some really powerful thoughts to me. And these messages are supposed to change us. And I think we're supposed to acknowledge it when we're being changed, and when we're growing in this area. Let's pray together. Lord, we're most grateful to you that we could be here right now. And thank you for these good, good truths that you show us. And we want them to translate into our lives. And we want to walk boldly. And we want to walk with your Spirit in us and to do good in the world. And we ask your blessings on us. And it's through Christ we pray. Amen.